The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to our first podcast of 2011. We're straight into the prize season with the announcement of the Costa category winners. With me to discuss them is Sarah Crown. And we'll be putting in a phone call about the children's winner to our children's books editor, Julia Eccleshare. Welcome back, Sarah. We didn't hear much from you towards the end of last year, did we?
No, I was off sick. I was off for a couple of weeks, which sort of extended into the podcast schedule. But I'm back now.
And it presumably gave you plenty of time to read.
Yes, lots of reading time. Okay. So that was a bonus.
So will you just run us through the list?
Yes, the Costa category winners this year are, for the novel award, The Hand That First Held Mine by Maggie O'Farrell. For the first novel award, Witness the Night by Kishwar Desai. For the biography award, The Hair with Amber Eyes by Edmund Duval. For the poetry award, Of Mutability by Jo Shapcott. And for the children's book award, Out of Shadows by Jason Wallace.
Gosh, there are quite a lot of them, aren't there? It always rather surprises me that there are five different categories at this stage.
Yeah.
Let's start with one that we've both read. That's Maggie O'Farrell's The Hand That First Held Mine. Sarah, you reviewed this for The Guardian back in the spring. Give us an idea of what it's about.
Yes, it's a book with two separate storylines, or we think that they're separate, certainly to begin with. One set in the 1950s going into the 1960s, and one that's set in the present day. And the storyline in the past deals with a woman called Lexi Sinclair, who is newly arrived in London. She's part of the Soho scene in the arts world, very dynamic, and it sort of traces her journey, her relationships, and she has a child. And the present day storyline features Alina, who's also has a child, has just given birth, and right in the teeth of new motherhood. And it sort of deals with how she copes with that sort of very difficult experience.
In the gums of new motherhood, perhaps.
Yes.
Because a lot of it is, it's very, very sort of gummy and intimate. And
yes.
I thought that was one of the great things about this book, is what it feels like to be in that sort of strange, timeless period.
Yes, that sort of soupy, hazy state where the hours don't really mean anything and days don't really mean anything. And it's a kind of constant present. It's a very odd time. And Maggie O'Farrell depicts it brilliantly. I think it's one of the few books that I've read that deals with that period of time.
Mm.
And it's sort of syrupy quality.
Now, I'm quite interested in the name. She's got a thing about names, hasn't she, Maggie O'Farrell? I'm always interested in them. And I would have had them the other way around, Alina and Lexi. Lexi sounds a more modern name, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, yes, it does. But she Lexi, the character, deliberately espouses it early
she's
on
fast,
in the book.
What one might call fast, or
yeah.
have called fast.
She
in
changes
the 50s.
Her name. She updates it to make her to sort of fit her personality better, and she sees herself as Alexi. So,
and one of the great points of this novel is what it says about Soho. It's like a sort of psychogeographical story as well, isn't it?
It is, and I think as a reader, this was the thing that has stayed with me the longest and most impressed me. In terms of the writing, was Maggie O'Farrell's ability to create London that is a layer on layer on layer, like a great big cake, and everything else that's underneath it is still there, and you've got this ghost grid of lives existing underneath your feet. And she shows that through offices in Soho that then become coffee shops and then resolve back into offices and houses that are then split up into flats and then again become big houses again. And it's just sort of, it's incredibly poignant. It's very moving, that aspect of it, the ephemerality of our lives.
And she does quite a clever thing with real people, doesn't she? So she has the sort of pub life, the Muriel Belcher pub life, and she has shadowy figures in the corner of pubs
who may or may not be
Francis Bacon. Yes. I thought that was very clever.
Yeah.
But in the end, I felt slightly dissatisfied. I'm struggling to find a formulation that doesn't involve giving the plot away, and perhaps I should stop now. It seemed to me that she had to do an awful lot of work in tying up the ends, and she tied them up maybe perhaps a little bit too neatly for me, tying the two plots together.
Yes, the sort of final ending itself is fairly open, and you're left with the present-day characters and wondering where they might go next with the information that they've sort of acquired, the knowledge that they've acquired. But I agree there is a sort of... there's a finality to the plot in the past, but maybe that's what everyone's life looks like at the end, possibly. You know, you get to the end and everything is kind of...
That's a very interesting point, actually, that she caught herself in a structure which meant that she had to finish off
stories,
the characters in the past. Yeah, well, there we go. Now, Maggie O'Farrell in Guardian Review last summer did a My Hero, and her hero was the poet Michael Donaghy, who, she wrote, taught me never to throw away a first draft, that every word must pull its weight, that good things come in threes, never to use abstracts, and to cut and cut and cut. Which is a great pointer, isn't it? And it brings us to our next category winner, which is the poetry.
Yes, this was won by Jo Shapcott for her collection of Mutability. And I interviewed her back when the collection came out sort of earlier in the summer. And she was really interesting to interview, and it's a very interesting collection.
And it's based on life experience. You interviewed her for this podcast way back in the spring again in Bart's hospital.
Yes.
Why was that?
Yes. Well, the reason for it was that the book of poetry isn't... I have to be quite careful here because Jo herself is quite careful when she talks about it. It came out of her experience of dealing with breast cancer. And she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2003. She underwent what she called the full gamut of treatments. She credits her oncology team in the credits of the collection. So it's very much kind of the bedrock of the collection that she's written. However, she is absolutely scrupulously clear on the point that it is not an autobiographical collection. It's not about her having breast cancer. It's about the things and the thoughts and the shift in perspective that comes out of it.
Mm-hmm. And one of the questions you asked her was whether it would be a good book to give to someone who's going through that experience. And she didn't think it would be, did she?
Well, not... I mean, from my own point of view, I think that it would be. And actually, you know, having been quite ill myself before Christmas, I found that I kept returning to these poems and thinking about them and drawing on them. But I think the point that she's making is that it's not a manual. It doesn't give you pointers as to how to kind of get on with it, how to cope with it. But it does give you a sense that someone else has been there before. Mm. And I think that can be very valuable. So I think she's slightly... was undercutting herself a bit, but I can see her point.
We've had quite a few high-profile collections in the last few years that have dealt with real-life experiences, haven't we? Last year's Costa overall winner was Christopher Reed's A Scattering, which was about the death of his wife. Do you think that poetry has to hit these sort of bells in order to make an impact these days?
I think that's a really good question, and I think it's possible that the answer is yes. In order to have a kind of a big populist support, it probably does need to be one of the big life-changing experiences that it deals with. I think that people approach poetry, the general public approaches poetry in times of heightened emotion, whether that's love. You know, we all go to poetry for love, we read poems at weddings, that's what we expect, that's what we use poetry for. And grief is the other big occasion when we would draw on poetry. Again, you think about funerals, the occasions when we sort of talk about grief, we draw on poetry for that. And so for a book to kind of break out of, you know, what we sort of derisively refer to as the poetry ghetto and have a big popular impact, it needs to be about a subject that people would tend to go to poetry for. And so I think that's probably why, with a more popular award like the Costas rather than the Fords or the T.S. Eliot Prize, the judges will look to subject as well as the quality of the verse, which isn't to say that Jo's verse isn't fantastic. So I really think it is,
and it'll be. And she's a blue blood, and she's very very experienced, isn't she? So now let's do a complete change of tack and go to the first of the two debuts on the list, and this is the children's category winner. Joining us on the line for this is Julia Eccleshare, our children's books editor.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about this. This is Jason Wallace, Out of the Shadows. We know nothing at all about it in this studio.
Ah, well, it's an incredibly interesting book. It's set in a boarding school in Zimbabwe at the time that Mugabe's just come to power. And so it's a very political novel, but it's very strongly set in a school. So it could also be read very much as a school story. And it's really a coming of age of the hero in this particular political moment, and it's absolutely excellent on place. I mean, it brings Africa to life. It brings the countryside very vividly to life. It brings the hope, the optimism of a society which really felt that the old order of racial discrimination would be broken down by Mugabe, and then charts the period for long enough to get to the time when actually it's all crumbling already. So it's a very, very powerful story.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of Spud, which of course is the South African bestseller, also a boarding school set book. Why are we so obsessed with boarding schools? And is this the right way to tell the story of Africa? These white or, you know, these post-colonial or colonial institutions?
Well, the point about this one is that it's a colonial institution going through change, and Mugabe comes to the school. And so in a way, it's quite a good symbol of the old becoming something different and adapting and crumbling. And that's the point it's making, that, you know, the old order is breaking down and schools where it's breaking down. And I suppose a boarding school is, in a sense, I mean, in children's books, the precinct novel, the idea of being set somewhere which is a very defined space which the children can explore safely is quite an important concept. And I suppose a boarding school is a very particular example of that. It's also, typically, you can very easily construct it as a place in which adults are very absent. So, you know, you get the kind of real fear of being bullied, or the real passion of friendships can be very intensely played out in that sort of structured but unsupervised environment. I think they make a very good, look at Harry Potter. I mean, I think Harry Potter's success is its school setting as much as its magic. Mm. Schools are very, very good settings for children's books.
It was interesting. I met the author of Spud in South Africa in the spring. And I said, why have you set this in the early 1980s? And he said he wouldn't presume to do a post-colonial novel because he was white. And do you think that's playing a part in this?
Yes, I do. And I think it's a very interesting time, when you look at where Mugabe is now and how he's perceived. I think it's actually fascinating and a very important thing for children to be taken back to look at why, when he first came to power, it was thought to be going to be so wonderful. And it's actually I found it a very sad book from that point of view, that the optimism just dwindles so quickly. Mm. And all the things that were going to be okay, and how the liberal whites thought everything would suddenly, very quickly, everything would get better, and the way it doesn't quite work out, because actually people's positions are very entrenched.
Mm. Sarah, let's go back a little bit to this boarding school theme, which I'm rather obsessed with. Why boarding schools? I came from one. I don't want to know anything more about boarding
schools.
Well,
I didn't go to a boarding school.
Well, funnily enough, or fortuitously enough, perhaps, we actually have a blog on the Guardian Books website today about this very question, it being the first day of term in the UK. John Lucas, who's blogging on it, goes back through the history of the boarding school novel, which actually apparently originally began in 1749 with an author called Sarah Fielding. Her only book, it was called The Governess, and it's apparently the first sort of school story that we have. And, you know, he discusses the pros and cons, and obviously it's, you know, establishment, you know, colonial, post-colonial, as you've said, but also it provides this sort of structure that's extremely appealing, and it's a microcosm of society. And so you have, you know, the bullies and the weak people and the kind people and all the, you know, the other elements of society are all mixed in together. So I think that's probably why it still appeals, because it's a manageable size and we can deal with it, and children equally can deal with those sort of, it's like a little village, isn't it? Those sort of interactions.
And you can have sort of monstrous characters within an enclosed structure, can't you?
And also, Claire, for those of us who didn't go to boarding school, this is a sort of endlessly fascinating, because it takes place behind closed doors that we've never been through. You know, so we don't really know what it might feel like. So I think there's a...
Bad, Julia, bad, I can tell you. an Amazon reviewer, interestingly, said, I'm rather surprised this has been shunted into the young adult ghetto, since it would undoubtedly interest an adult audience. What do you think of that, Julia?
Well, I think actually it's a very, very good children's book, and I think it's horrible to think that it's been shunted there. I think it was written for children, and I think it keeps a very clear children's perspective throughout the book. And lots of people have written, you know, the adult experience of this, and I think that there is a place for a book that is written for children about children. And if adults want to read it, that's fine. I'm very happy for them to read it. But I think an author is entitled, and indeed should be encouraged, to write exactly this kind of book for a very particular readership.
We haven't had a children's book winning the Costa since, was it 2003, when The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime won?
Yes, which is possibly the only true crossover book anyway. So, though it was it was published as an adult book as well, but it was entered as a children's book. Yes, I mean, it is one of the gripes of the children's authors that they have never won. And indeed, when Philip Pullman won famously with The Amber Spyglass, he'd initially held his book he'd made it be published on a later date so that it wouldn't be eligible for the then Whitbreads, because he was so angry that the children's authors never seemed to actually scoop the pool.
I wonder whether there's a point in this which relates to what we were saying earlier about poetry and the importance of crossover in reaching a big poetry audience. It's a different sort of crossover, isn't it?
But it's exactly the same point, that, I mean, poetry and children's books are seen to reach a very specific audience, and actually, of course, they have much wider reach than that. But I don't really see why, even if you only reach a smaller part of the audience, you shouldn't be still deemed the best of the five books.
Yeah, so it's very good at doing what it sets out to do.
Yeah, if it does it best, of all of the five. I mean, The Other may be a very good novel or a very good first novel, but if this does it, you know, if this is an absolute, you know, first-class exemplar of a children's book, then I can't see why it shouldn't win the whole shoot.
But Sarah, there's an issue of stature, isn't there, here? I mean, you want a book of stature to win a big multi-generic prize.
Of course, but then you could also argue that because it's a big multi-generic prize, it has not only the possibility, but perhaps even the duty to say, this is, you know, we're going to make you read these books of genres that you might not necessarily read otherwise. But they've got, you know, they've got a platform. Mm. And genres like children's fiction and poetry often lack a platform, and so the cost is, you know, should do something about it.
Well, and by setting up this you know, apparent jump off between the five different groups, that's what, in a way, we all led to believe would happen, that the best children's book could win, even if it wasn't so well known, even if, you know, nobody in the general domain, as it were, had heard of Out of the Shadows. There's no reason why it shouldn't win, of course.
Mm-hmm. Julia, thank you very much. Let's move on now to the other debut, which is actually the prize for first novel, so of course it would be a debut, and it is Kishwa Desai's Witness of the Night. It's a crime novel, which makes it a bit of an unusual category winner, isn't it, Sarah?
Generally speaking, as you know, as we've just discussed, genre of all types is less well represented on prize shortlists and indeed amid prize winners. The Booker, for example, famously, you know, doesn't go to science fiction writers, doesn't go to crime writers. And genre is, again, and I think this will be the third time we've used the word in this podcast, but again, it's a ghetto. But as we've said already, the Costas are a more populist award, and crime is an extremely
the
popular
The most popular
genre.
Of
yeah.
all, really,
yes,
isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Tell us who Kishwa Desai is.
She's a very interesting woman. This is her first book, but it's not as if she hasn't been doing other stuff instead. She's a journalist, and she's a committed social campaigner, and she's married to the Labour peer Lord Desai, so she has quite a high public profile.
And it sounds a little bit worthy to me.
It sounds pretty serious. It's about gendercide, which, slightly as the name suggests, is about the killing of members of one gender or another. In this case, it's the killing of girls in the Punjab in India. And there's it starts with a 14-year-old girl who's found beaten up and tied to a bed inside a house in which there are 13 dead bodies. And a social worker is charged with getting her to talk about it.
She's mute, isn't she? She's
yes,
so traumatised.
She's completely
she can't
traumatised,
speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they think that she's done the murders.
Yes.
Yeah. But, of course, it all unravels. It's not, as one would expect,
yes.
predictable.
Yeah,
again, we're getting ourselves into trouble, aren't we, again, with this business of plot, which we really mustn't give away, because we have to assume, particularly being a debut novel, a lot of people won't have read it. Suffice to say that Laura Wilson, reviewing it in The Guardian, said, "There's a bit too much theorising, but this sad and thought-provoking tale is certainly worth a read." And finally, to the winner of the Biography Prize. And it isn't actually a biography at all, as you will know from the Guardian coverage of the long-listing stage, unless you think of it as a biography of 265 Netsuke. Sarah, for anybody who hasn't heard this podcast, because we have been banging the drum very loudly for this book for a very long time, what are Netsuke?
Yes, these are the tiny little sort of engraved carvings, toggles, basically, for kimono belts.
You could say it's a biography, I suppose, in the sense that it follows these
loosely
carved toggles. And if we can have a biography of cancer, which I've just sent out for review, you can
right,
sure as anything
goodness
have
me.
I don't see why you can't have a biography of a belt toggle. However, it is a bigger story than that. It's the story of late 19th and 20th century Europe, really, stretching from the Jewish exodus from Russia in the late 19th century through their accumulation of unbelievable wealth to the destruction in the terrible pogroms that preceded the Second World War. And it takes in Proust and the Impressionists, and the most amazing character of all, who in a way is the least interiorised character, is the humble lady's maid who amazingly saves the collection. But one feature, Sarah, is that it doesn't actually have any Netsuke in the book. You can't actually see what one looks like. And it's beautifully designed. Tell us, Edmund de Valle is a potter, isn't he? So he's
yes.
got, and he's obviously, his fingerprints are all over the design of this book.
Yes, it's very kind of luxurious, gorgeous thing to look at. But as you say, there aren't any pictures of the objects themselves, which is
what?
A bit of a lack.
Why? Well, how on earth did that happen?
I really don't know. I mean, I'm sure, but, you know, when it comes out in paperback, that will be addressed.
They are beautiful objects, and you can actually see them on the Guardian website. We've got a gallery
yes.
of the real things that he showed us, haven't we?
Yes, and definitely worth looking at.
Where do we find those?
If you go to guardian.co.uk/books, we'll have a big package of Costa coverage, and we called it an audio slideshow. It's basically Edmund Duval talking over the top of a lot of these images. You can go and have a look at it there. And it's really worth doing. They're remarkable things.
So that's it for the five contenders for the prize, which will be announced on the 25th of January. Sarah, this is the point at which I always ask you to stick your neck out. And I have to say, I was going back over the prize podcast of the last year, and you were actually right about several of them, including Howard Jacobson, very clearly, yes.
So come on. Bad.
Come on, give us your tip.
Okay, well, I'd say, given that we're doing this podcast from The Guardian, and everyone on The Guardian's books desk is completely in love with Edmund Duval and his book, I guess I'd probably go for him. But if he doesn't win it, and it's slightly esoteric, so perhaps he won't, I'd say Maggie O'Farrell, I think, probably.
And you always do get this backlash, don't you? And there's almost been too big a following wind behind the hair,
yes,
hasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it really has gone from sort of zero to hero, I think.
It had the second biggest number of recommendations in the Guardian Books of the Year after Jonathan Franzen. It was only a couple behind Jonathan Franzen, which is an amazing achievement.
If you consider the different degrees of publicity that those two books got, and the different sort of levels of push from the publisher, and to have them basically coming out pretty much neck and neck is amazing, really.
The tortoise and the hare, two hairs.
Very good.
There ain't no tortoises in this race. And that's it, all from us in this special Costa Prize podcast. Join us on Friday for something altogether more bracing. Yes, we'll be looking, among other things, at the self-help literature that you may feel you need to help you recover from the excesses of the festive season. Until then, from me, Sarah, Julia, and our producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.